And we're back with Unusual Sources here on 93.3 CFMU FM. And we're the program that brings you the interviews you don't ordinarily get to hear, whether it's people from the community or people from abroad, international issues. We allow all of these different voices to be heard here in Hamilton, and all thanks to CFMU and its listener-supported, community-funded radio. And today, we should be having an interview with Allison Weir, and she is the executive director of If Americans Knew, which is an organization dedicated to raising awareness of the role of Americans and the American government, more specifically, in supporting the Israeli government. But it's also a big investigation about the role of the media in the Israel-Palestine conflict. Well, Allison has done detailed studies on that, and she spoke last week at McMaster. We should have her on the line with us today. So let's see. Allison, are you here with us today?
Yes, I am. Thank you for having me.
Excellent. Okay, you're coming in fairly clearly. Well, Allison, again, thank you. And we had you live in the studio, and it's great to have you here at McMaster. And it's also great to follow up on that previous interview. We didn't have a lot of time last time. We only had about 10 minutes to really give a preview of your lecture series, and what your organization is all about. We know, in terms of your background, that you had edited a newspaper and done work in journalism. You became interested in the issue of Israel-Palestine after the uprising, I suppose, in Palestine, the Intifada, circa 2000. Is this the time when you noticed the bias in the media? Is that when you started picking up on it?
That's correct. I was at that time the editor of a small newspaper in Northern California. And the kind of newspaper that just reports on the local community, largely the city council, the school district. But that's also the time when the uprising began, the second Palestinian uprising, the second Intifada, it's often called. And I grew curious about it because it was in the news quite a bit, and you would see some of these images, sometimes of children really literally throwing stones against tanks. So it got my attention. I started to follow news coverage of it, just out of curiosity, not part of my job as a journalist. And when I was following the news coverage, I noticed fairly quickly that it seemed to me that it was Israeli-centric, that we were hearing from and about Israelis a great deal, which I wanted to get all of the information. But when I waited to hear from and about Palestinians, I noticed that that came so much less frequently. And because of that, I started looking into the issue more for myself.
So you went from noticing bias to conducting a full-fledged study on the bias.
That's right. Although in between, what happened is when I began to look into the bias, really I began just looking into the issue, trying to learn what really was going on every day, using the internet and international websites and international news, especially from within the Palestinian territories themselves and from within Israel itself. And what I discovered was really so shocking and astounding, what was going on, and the fact that it was not being covered in the U.S. media. I finally, after a few months of looking into it, quit my job in Sausalito, California, and traveled over as a freelance reporter, traveling throughout Gaza and the West Bank as a freelance journalist. So then when I came back is when I began looking into the press coverage and doing real studies of news coverage.
We'll certainly have to talk about it, get into your journey to Palestine. That was quite courageous. Suppose afterwards you did conduct this study of U.S. media, and is it right that you had your son's help on this later?
Yes, we did. We had what I would do is hire some people to work on this specific project, you know, somebody to sort of a research assistant who would gather a lot of the data. And we had actually about three different people at different times working on this. Students from mostly from students who had graduated from University of California at Berkeley, because at this time my office was in Berkeley, California, and then for one of them, my son, who is a PhD student at Caltech, and had been a physics and math student at UC Berkeley, so I felt he was qualified to do a statistical study, which is what ours are.
Interesting, yes. I know you certainly can't show us all the graphs and flowcharts and whatnot over the radio, but what were some of the general conclusions that you discovered when you looked at the different instances of media analysis, representation, and reporting in the Israel-Palestine conflict?
Well, what we wanted to do was do a statistical type of study, you know, as close to a scientific study as possible that would be really immune from subjective bias. And so we decided to look at how deaths were covered in the U.S. media. And the main point to always remind people is that it's important to study the deaths of both populations, Israelis and Palestinians, to get a comparison. You know, often our media just give us the quantity of one population, and usually it's just the Israeli population. But we wanted to look at how they covered both populations' deaths, that are, all of these deaths are tragic. And what we discovered, for example, was looking at the first year of the uprising, because first impressions are so significant. They set the context within which people ever after view a conflict. So we looked at the first year of this uprising, and we just discovered in that first year, 28 Israeli children had been killed by Palestinians, and 131 Palestinian children had been killed by Israelis. We got those statistics from B'Tselem, an Israeli human rights organization that's very reliable in gathering data. So at a time when, really in every period of time, Palestinian children have been killed in far larger numbers than Israelis. So this was true right from that very first year. And yet, while Palestinian children were being killed in far greater numbers, we found that the primetime network news programs, ABC, CBS, and NBC, were covering Israeli children's deaths at far greater rates than Palestinian children's deaths, sometimes as high as 13 and 14 times greater. They were reporting on Israeli children's deaths than Palestinians.
Well, that's incredible. You have examples where if you graphed it, you'd see the number of Palestinian deaths, whether civilian in general or children in particular, mm-hmm. would be very high, much higher than the number of Israeli children. But when it comes to reporting those, with the number of reports on those, you would see figures where the Israeli deaths are perhaps reported even more than the total Palestinian deaths.
That's right. Yeah. Another situation, we found that a regional newspaper in California, in Silicon Valley, a fairly major California newspaper, we looked at their front page headlines, because many of us are so busy, you know, those are the stories that we're at least aware of, that we might not have time for the full news coverage, but we look at the front page headlines. Those are the big stories of the day. And in that study, we found that the front page headline coverage had reversed the situation. They had reported on far more Israeli deaths than Palestinian deaths, even though the opposite had been going on. Even though Palestinians had been killed in far greater numbers than Israelis, somebody looking at front page headlines would have thought it was the opposite.
Now, it's my understanding that media monitoring organizations, I think including Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, have looked at your statistics, they've evaluated your reports, and they've come to support your conclusions. Is that right?
That's right. Especially there was an organization called Grade the News. It was run by a Stanford professor. We emailed him our results and told him about our study. This so intrigued him and interested him that they then undertook their own study, and it corroborated ours. They found that we were accurate, and they found additional similar information proving that. Another organization, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, FAIR, that has also been around for many years and works on many issues. It doesn't just focus on the Middle East. They had done a study about National Public Radio, NPR coverage of Israel-Palestine, and they found that in that case, NPR had reported on Israeli children's deaths. Almost 90% of Israeli children's deaths were covered. They were considered that important to NPR, whereas Palestinian children's deaths were reported, only 20% of those had been reported.
Yes.
And I should emphasize to people that this means that we don't know the actual sequence of the killing. The actual fact is that Palestinian, because, you know, I can guess that some people might be saying, well, you know, but Israel has to defend its population. It's very tragic. But after all, they have to fight back if they're being attacked by Palestinians. But when you look at the actual facts, what really occurred is that Palestinians, both Palestinians of all ages and Palestinian children, were killed before Israelis were killed, before Israeli children were killed. We just didn't see those reports. So then after several months of Palestinian children being killed, in fact, I believe it was 3.5 months they were killed, at least 82 Palestinian children. Only after that was an Israeli child killed. And that's when we first learned about a child being killed. So people think that it's, you know, they think that quantitatively it's the reverse of what it actually is. And chronologically, they also are led to believe it's the reverse of what it actually is.
Well, I would argue that the Israeli media or the Israeli government often tries to frame any violence they conduct as retaliatory. So they'll want to show Palestinian violence occurring first and then Israeli violence occurring as a reaction to that.
That's right. That's exactly the way the Israeli government spins it that way. And we find that the general U.S. media also spin it that way.
This is an issue that you've become particularly sensitized to. You mentioned how you were able to learn quite a different story, really change your perspective on things when you toured Palestine. I know that must have been a transformative event for you. So I'm just wondering, how did that whole process go? You just book a ticket to Gaza or West Bank and fly over there, or what?
Well, almost. It was, I did just buy a ticket. You can't actually book a ticket to Gaza, because Israel controls the airspace and the borders. So even though, for instance, now I would love to go directly to Gaza, that's impossible. Gaza is a prison, and Israel holds the keys. So there used to be, for a very brief time, there was an airport in Gaza, but Israel quickly destroyed it. So there's really no way to go directly to Gaza. But what I did is I did just spontaneously and very quickly, because I wanted to go right away once I made the decision to do this, I traveled to Ben-Gurion Airport, which is in Israel, and then I traveled into the West Bank and Gaza Strip, going through checkpoint after checkpoint to be able to do that. That part was difficult. You know, there are long lines trying to get through checkpoints, and the Israeli soldiers who are controlling entry into the Palestinian territories don't always let you in. The first time I tried to go to Gaza, this was in 2001, they did not allow me to go in, even though I was going there as a journalist. They just prohibited me from entering, and in fact, that day, they allowed no one to go in. I then came back the next day, and fortunately that day, I was able to go in, and that's when I traveled around just by myself. It was a little confusing and difficult, but I managed to do it. People would invite me to stay in their homes, so quite often I would stay in Palestinian homes. And I saw incredible devastation in civilian neighborhoods that were bullet-riddled, you know, buildings that were largely demolished. People in some places, they had mattresses in the center of their home, the center of their bullet-riddled home that had, holes through the walls that they felt would be safer, you know, that was the place they were living.
Well,
it's very, 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 very intense experience to have done that. I was visited hospitals in Gaza, and I did this, I've done this since too. Last year I spent 3 months traveling around the West Bank, and on these trips I visited hospitals where I would see children that had been shot by Israeli soldiers. I saw children that had been shot in the head, in the stomach, in the back, in the leg, in the teeth. They're not difficult to find because so many have been shot by Israeli soldiers.
Many of them won't be walking again.
That's right.
You mentioned safety, and I'm just wondering, as an American, as someone who probably stood out, did you feel safe or did you feel dangerous in that environment?
I felt safe. You know, that's the thing also, that there's so many things that you experience that are different from the way the conditions are described in the American media. The reality was that on all of my trips, Palestinians have been very welcoming, very friendly. They are so happy that an American journalist is coming to see what's going on and to visit. So people, of course, didn't immediately know I was a journalist, but they certainly could tell I was not Palestinian. I have, my coloring is fair. I have blonde hair. I'm very European-American looking, and, I just dress my normal way. And so I certainly, it was easy to tell I was a foreigner. And people were very friendly and would say hello to me and would welcome me. They would want to, and when I was going through the areas that were especially bullet-riddled, people would come and want to show me their homes and you know, they would want me to take pictures of what was going on to show the rest of the world and to show Americans what was going on. So I consistently, from the Palestinian population, felt surprisingly welcomed, even though it's my government that is very responsible for what's going on there and my tax money that Israel is using. Nevertheless, I found people very friendly and very welcoming to me as an American and to the other Americans that I would see there.
As a United States citizen, did they have expectations, either perhaps because you're a journalist or an American, did they think you could do anything?
They would sometimes think I could do something, and sadly, I couldn't. But in one case, there was a boy who had been shot by Israeli forces, and he was very badly injured. And his parents asked me if I could try to get care for their son. Either, you know, they thought, and I thought too, that maybe I could arrange for a medical team to come to Gaza, or arrange for some way for their son to be taken out of Gaza and maybe brought to an American hospital. So I asked the doctor about that, and he explained to me that he had not yet told the parents because he was trying to find the right time to tell them and the right way to tell them. But he said that their son was completely and eternally paralyzed, that there was no care that would make any difference for their son.
It must have been tragic for you knowing things about what's going to happen to these children, and people were hoping you could do something, but of course, what can you do?
It was so sad because the mother was right there. She didn't speak English. I'd been using an interpreter, and that's how I had, you know, received her question. And so the doctor was telling me this about her son in front of her. And, you know, so now I knew this tragic thing about her son that she didn't even know. So, and I knew there was nothing that anybody could do.
Well, I guess when you left and came back, I mean, you've done a special video, I understand, on Israeli strip searches. Now, I hope you were not subject to strip searches.
I was not, fortunately. I'm very happy that has not happened to me so far. But it happens to so many people. It's random. It's a random practice. It doesn't happen. Not everybody that's foreign or everybody that's a Palestinian gets strip searched at the borders. Not everyone by any means. But at different periods, from what we've been able to tell, it seems to have been a random practice. And without even doing an intense investigation, I stumbled across a number of cases where people would tell me that are now in their 30s or maybe 40s, or in one case in her 20s, that they had been strip searched as children. These are women. So as little girls, they were strip searched by Israeli guards at borders, sometimes at external borders, sometimes right within the Palestinian territories, just going from one point to another area. And there were different methods that were used. In some cases, women or children or men or old men would be taken, but let's just give the example of a child, would be taken, this, I'll give an example of a Christian child, actually, from Nazareth, which means the family was theoretically Israeli citizens. We always hear that Israel's a democracy. Well, these were Israeli citizens, but they were Christians. This was a Christian Palestinian family living in Nazareth. When they were departing at the airport, this little 9-year-old girl was taken away from her parents into a cubicle and strip searched. She described how that felt to her, how terrifying it was, and how humiliating, and that now she has never returned to the family home in Nazareth because she just can't psychologically bring herself to go there, knowing that Israeli soldiers could do anything they want to her, and she would be helpless against that.
Absolutely. She can't be the only person who suffered psychological effects as a result.
And in other cases, they don't take the children away from the mother. They just strip search them all together, right in the same room. So I heard other cases where a child had been next to her mother, and they were strip searched together. I won't go into some of the grotesque details, but they're on our website and in our video. In some cases, this part is not in our video. We learned about this afterwards. In some cases, mothers and their sons are strip searched in the same room. You know, this is just humiliating, cruel behavior, and it violates international law that requires that women and children privacy be respected and that they not be humiliated.
No one is really safe from this. I think you mentioned there was the 76-year-old Holocaust survivor.
That's right. In fact, I think she was 78 years old. Holocaust survivor that was strip searched for no reason. You know, this was clearly to humiliate her and to try to make her suffer. They not only strip searched her, they internally searched her. A 78-year-old Jewish Holocaust survivor.
Well,
her crime had been that she had been in the Palestinian territories. She had been working with nonviolent, peaceful groups in the Palestinian territories, and because of that, they then did this to her when she left the country.
You mentioned your website, so if people do want the video documentary on this, can they see it on your website?
Yes, they can. Our website is ifamericansknew.org. ifamericansknew.org. They can see it on our website. They can also contact us. We will mail people a DVD that contains this video and other videos. And we're hoping people will get that. We invite people to pirate it. We want people to copy it and give it out to as many other people as you'd like to try to expose what's going on. Because the U.S. media, none of the U.S. media that we have covered any of this, even Democracy Now, has so far refused to cover the strip searching.
And this is very depressing, but I mean, it's not all bad. You've mentioned your website, and certainly you've attracted enough attention to be going on lecture tours, lecture circuits, and you have come to McMaster University here. It was quite an exciting event that you were at with your video, your lecture, and there were many questions from the audience. What kind of reception would you say you received here in Hamilton, or perhaps in general? How are people taking this?
Well, in general and at McMaster, the vast majority of the audience is very receptive, without exception. That has been the case, that the majority of the audience is very interested, extremely troubled to learn the facts, and in general say, what can we do about this? And ask, you know, very good questions about the coverage and about the situation. Unfortunately, frequently, not always, but every so often, there are people in the audience who are very hostile to these facts. They're very emotionally committed and loyal to Israel, and I believe they're in denial about what Israel has done in the past and is currently doing. It's hard if you're focusing on Israel. I think it would be very difficult not to know the facts. But given the reality that in many cases they're brought up to believe that they must protect Israel, that Israel would never do anything wrong, and if Israel does, it's somebody else's fault that they've done that. So you find people that are very emotionally attached to Israel, in denial about what Israel does, in denial that there even is such a thing as Palestinians sometimes, and Palestinian human rights. And these people will have various responses. Sometimes, unfortunately, they're quite rude. Sometimes they're a bit disruptive. At McMaster, some of the people in the audience, a very small number, I think my guess is it was only about 6 or 7 people, who were adults, not students, adults from whom one would expect appropriate behavior, who were borderline inappropriate. They were at times making inappropriate noise during the presentation. One woman, an adult, was playing an iPod quite loudly. You know, this is very bizarre behavior. I would do my best during the question and answer period to answer everybody's question as respectfully as possible, and I of course did that with their questions. And yet, rather than listen to my answer, they would sort of shout out over it. So that part was disturbing. But fortunately, as I said, that was a very tiny proportion of these adults who were in the audience. But it was disturbing because, from what I've told, some of those adults were faculty at McMaster, or at least were staff members at the university. And I did find that extremely surprising.
Well, it looks like some people, or we could all of us take a page from McMaster Muslims for Peace and Justice at that particular event and their cordial handling of the event. They certainly set aside guidelines and rules of good behavior so that it wouldn't turn into a disruptive fracas.
Yes, that's right.
Well, I know it's probably a slow crawl in trying to get the facts out for you, but certainly you're one of many groups and people and organizations struggling for human rights and justice and media monitoring on all of these issues. So I really commend your work, and I'm glad you're doing it, and certainly people here at McMaster are glad you're doing it as well. So Allison, thanks very much for coming on our program today.
Thank you, and thank you so much for what you're doing and for having me on your program again.